to move on from the first three factors of awakening, or controlling faculties of mind, really. As I mentioned yesterday, I picked this topic because these five qualities of mind, to the degree that they're present or not present and in balance, control the unfolding of the mind or condition the unfolding of the mind. And particularly when these factors are aroused and in balance, it establishes a balance of mind or an equanimity of mind that is not just the equanimity of non-reaction, emotional reaction. It's a balancing of the factors and the faculties of mind. And when the mind comes into that kind of balance, it not only is equanimous affectively in relation to the stimulation in life, where you're not caught in aversion and desire and reaction of one sort or another. It's not only that, but the functioning of the mind is in balance. The perceptual function, the cognitive function, as well as the affective relationship to things. And this degree of balance of mind is, we'd say, this is the healthy mind. And the healthy mind gives rise to healthy materiality, body stuff. In the Buddhist understanding of the material world and the material elements of a being like our body, there are four recognized sources of the material that makes up the body. And the first, of course, is karma. We're born due to karmic accumulations as human this lifetime, male or female, depending on karmic predispositions. And the ongoingness of life is a karmic result. We have a body that experiences things, and the experiences are all karmic results. So the main bundle of root cause of our experience, material experience, is karmic. So there is a karmic profile that we're all born with, as well as, I mentioned, just a genetic profile. And the karmic profile is not a determinant of what you experience, but it does set some parameters or some boundaries on what can be experienced. So within that, healthier material elements can be conditioned by the other three sources of material. So, you know, to put that in layman's language, you know, the Buddha said, when asked, why is it some people are born wealthy and some are born in poverty? Why is it some beings are very intelligent and some are very dull and not so bright? Why is it that some are born and live a very healthy, long life? Why is it some are born kind of sickly and can never kind of get their health together and die young? He said, these conditions are the result of karma. And those who, and he gave, for example, those who harm others as a karmic act, the karmic result of that is being born and having not such good health. Those who kill others will, as a karmic result of that, if not in this lifetime or in some other lifetime, will die young. And so there are these parameters that the karmic seed that sprouted to give rise to this particular lifetime has some, you know, there's a karmic flame, and it's got a certain, it's not predetermined, but it's got a certain limit, and it may burn the whole candle or it may not, but it's not going to be a longer candle. So karmically, our physicality in this lifetime is somewhat determined by karma. Of course, the next most maybe predominant or noticeable condition for material experience is the environment you live in. If you live in a very unhealthy water, unhealthy food, unhealthy air, noisy, whatever, it has effect on one's health. If you live in an area where you can have access to clean water, clean air, good environmental conditions, that obviously has an effect on one's health. The third element is food. Depending on the quality, quantity, and prana, whatever that is, of food, you can not necessarily control your health, but you certainly can affect your health. And that there's a lot to be yet to be discovered and accepted, I suppose, about that. But it's pretty obvious to each one of us that food has its own effect. And the fourth element, of course, is the mind. The quality of the mind affects one's health. And, of course, the body is continually replenishing the, you know, dying cells and the materiality that is born and exists for a while and passes away, and we're continually being reconstituted. If our mind is continually in a healthy place, balanced and active but not too sluggish place, then it's going to condition healthy materiality, lively and responsive rather than damaged in some way. So this is a kind of a 2-minute tutorial on the Buddhist understanding of the mind giving rise to or conditioning the birth and the growth and replacement of unhealthy material in the body with healthy material in the body because of the quality of the mind. I won't go into some of the stories I was telling on Friday night, but just to mention that in the meditation center where I was ordained in Burma, there has been compiled a little manual of, I guess what you'd have to say are miracle cures. People who've come to the meditation center to practice meditation, to strive for the Dharma, to really see, to get to the bottom of the Dharma, to, in our language, to realize Nibbana. That's what Burmese people go to the meditation center for, is to realize the Dharma, which means to attain Nibbana. And when they go to do that, some people come because of their aspiration for liberation. Some come because they've been diagnosed with some condition that scares the bejesus out of them. And they want to get the Dharma before they die, or before they go into an operation, or before this cancer gets worse, or this tumor gets whatever, or as a possible antidote to a condition that they're living with, arthritis, skin conditions. There's just many, many stories of many different people who have come to the monastery, practiced just what we practice here, awareness. But I guess in our language we'd say they experience a health crisis, and for almost all of them the symptoms of their condition get magnified. They just get much worse and they suffer terrifically. But because of their faith in their teacher and because of their, you know, this is the end of the line, this is the last option. Western medical and Burmese medical isn't working, this is the end of the line. They are just determined to get the Dharma even if it kills them. Or I should say, if they're going to die, they want to get the Dharma first. And so they have that kind of no holds barred, no restraint, go for the Dharma, and just absolute faith in the teacher's guidance. And of course, when they get to this health crisis, you know, their relatives are saying, you got to get out of there, you know, you got to leave the meditation center, you got to go back to the hospital, you got to come home, we got to take care of you. Or the doctor saying, if you continue, you will die. And they say, well, you know, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die with the Dharma. And, you know, all of the stories end with, you know, they have these miraculous cures. Not unpainful, but they go through these extraordinary, you know, within these detailed recountings of what they experienced and how fearful they were and how many days they were just sweating bullets and how many days, you know, the skin was peeling off or whatever. Just extraordinary, scary symptoms, on the other end of which they emerge with no symptoms, never to return. And their doctors and families and others are just like amazed, like, what did you possibly do? And, you know, all they did was went to the meditation center and practiced meditation. So are these Western-based, scientific, documented, repeatable experiments? No. But some of them are, they're all first-person testimonials, some are have second-person confirmation, some have third-person confirmation. So it's not a matter of science, but it is a matter of belief. And I think it's interesting to just mention and to take note that they weren't practicing in order to cure themselves. They weren't practicing with the motivation to get rid of a particular medical condition. They were practicing to realize the truth, the result of which was the body healed itself. Fascinating. How does it happen? Well, as we all know, the mind has incredible capacity, and it somehow it's making it available. In this meditation center where I was practicing, there is the understanding that this path of practice is the path of purification. We purify our minds, we purify our speech and behavior of unskillful actions, we purify our minds of the defilements, and we purify our understanding of delusion. And so it's a path of purification during which, as you purify the mind, sometimes you come across stuff that manifests in the body as symptoms of disease. And maybe some of you, you know, have experienced some of this, maybe not, but there are times when people appear in retreat with symptoms. They just, you know, skin conditions and allergic reactions and temperature fluctuations. Some people are sweating bullets in a freezing cold room, and some are wrapped in blankets on a 110 degree day and can't keep warm. And it is just amazing, dramatic stories of and experiences and people that I've seen who've had purification coming out through the body symptoms. And the understanding in the meditation center is, don't do anything for 3 days. Just keep practicing. If you're still alive and you get the symptoms at 3 days, then you can go to the doctor. And almost everything clears up in 3 days, within 3 days of, if you're practicing. If you're practicing with that kind of fearless, follow the rules, or follow the teacher's instruction and just do it, almost everything clears up. Not easy to pay attention to terrifying symptoms for 3 days and still have a balanced mind. But that's the direction of practice. And maybe that's why they all get to this place in their mind of understanding. You know, I don't care if I die. I am going to get this Dharma. And there's a letting go of a lot there, a lot that we don't even know what we let go of sometimes. And yet there's a letting go of a lot of demands on life, which may be unhealthy. And when you let go, then your mind finds a way to bring the body back into health. I'm not offering it as an alternative to Western medicine, but it's a good compliment. The fourth of the spiritual or the controlling faculties that gets aroused in practice is what's called samadhi, or stability of mind, sometimes concentration or collectedness of mind. And it is nothing more than, now that's not quite the right way to put it, it is simply a result of the continuity of awareness. Continuity of awareness is the determinant for the degree of collectedness of mind, or the degree of samadhi. Now, if you just want to develop samadhi, you still have to develop continuity of awareness. But you can do it with a single object like the breath, or loving kindness, or a sound like a mantra, or a visualization, and just repeatedly send your mind to this object, continual awareness, or as continuous as possible on this object. The mind gets very secluded from the hindrances or the defilements. And when the mind gets secluded from the defilements, there's nothing to agitate the mind. There's no desire, there's no aversion, there's no sleepiness, no restlessness, no frustration, disappointment, fear, anxiety. It doesn't get in. The mind is locked onto that object, that sight, that sound, that object. And nothing gets in. And so the subjective experience is that the mind feels very calm. It's just so calm. It's just unwavering. It's just locked in, and it's just tum. And so the mind is unwavering, and when the mind is unwavering, it gives rise to great feelings of tranquility and calmness in the body. And so the subjective physical mental experience is of increasing calmness. However, when you practice vipassana or insight practice, the awareness is as continuous, but the object is continually changing. So the awareness is of one moment the in-breath, then the out-breath, then a sound, then a thought, then a memory, and a plan, and a judgment, and an itch, and And so while the awareness is as continuous, with the object changing moment by moment and rapidly, there is no subjective feeling of calmness. But the mind's is stable. And so we talk about the stability of mind in Vipassana practice, the stability of the attention. It's continuous. It's not a single thing that remains continuous, but it's a rapidly flexing repeated moment of awareness. Aware, 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 even though the objects are changing. A couple of things happen. In Vipassana, of course, or in samadhi or concentration practice, the mind gets purified. And when the mind is purified of the hindrances, I said there's in samatha or concentration practice, there's the feeling, subjective feeling of great calmness. In Vipassana, while we may not have the subjective feeling of great calmness, there is still this feeling of stability in the mind. And it's as if we could settle back into or just observing this rapidly fluxing flow of random, or I should say diverse, experiences. And while that's all going on, just out of reach, so to speak, the feeling is that nothing is moving. You know the image, in the 2001 Space Odyssey at the end, where all time and all space is just rapidly zooming by, or you could either see the observer is going through it, or the observer is standing still and everything is flying by. Well, it's like that. Things are just going by, and the observing is not moving. It's just still, non-reactive. Great equanimity arises with that kind of stillness of mind. But what happens when the mind gets that stable is everything gets magnified. A little tranquility feels like big tranquility. A little bit of excitement feels explosively, you know, exciting. A little bit of lust is like, can't control it. A little bit of, you know, gratitude is just gushy. Everything gets magnified to what in the teacher jargon is referred to as yogi mind. It's yogi mind is defined as the magnification of the insignificant to crisis proportion. And the amazing thing is the yogi doesn't know it. They really think this is a crisis. You know, and they come to the teacher and they talk about this. You know, and the teacher sees this is absolutely insignificant. And yet the yogi has to deal with it emotionally as the crisis that they perceive it to be. So you can't just dismiss it and say, oh, blow it off, it's nothing real. But you do have to give them a reality check. You know, no, it's not really happening that way. And still they have to deal with it. But that's what happens when the mind gets concentrated. Everything gets magnified. Not only the objects of our experience, but our sense of ourself. So, when you have a sense that, oh, practice is really going well, and that gets magnified, it's pretty easy to get pretty self-satisfied and inflated with your practice. And so, a little bit of clarity, and we're a little bit of calmness, and we're like, yeah. A little bit of understanding, a little bit of, you know, you start to see things, how they work. And we get inflated. We just get this unrealistic, inflated sense of ourself, which then becomes a hindrance. Because we get attached to it. We like being inflated, frankly. We like it. We're just full of ourselves and love it. So it's a challenge to practice in a way that everything gets magnified and not to get attached to what you see with the magnified mind. So this is a challenge in guiding others or in your own practice, is just to acknowledge the inevitable pleasant experiences that occur when the mind gets concentrated. When the mind gets concentrated, things calm down, the mind gets clear, perceptions are sharp, energy is effortless, you know, you just understand things with just the slightest whiff of explanation, and it happens because the mind is so collected and so unshaken, it's just ripe. On the other hand, all of those experiences also get kind of hijacked into a greater sense of oneself, and that then it becomes a problem. Then it becomes a limitation on practice that needs to be acknowledged, just like every other experience in our awareness. Is this interesting? Are you following? Yeah, it's not too far away. Huh? Okay, so this is the fourth of the controlling faculties, and without concentration, it's just not possible to see deeply beneath the surface of our mental chatter. The narrative of our life is just, you know, the narrative of our life just weaves all of our experience into me, the story of me. And it's just a story. And on the everyday level, we live our story. We live out of our story. We live into our story. Everything about us and everything around us gets woven into it. And it's all about the story of me. And there's no liberation there. We can be happy. We can rearrange it. But we can't get out of it until you really collect the mind. And when the mind gets really collected and really some level of samadhi or stability, then you can see through the illusion of the story to the way things really are. I talk about it, or I give an example, you know, a tapestry. You walk into a museum or an art gallery, and on the opposite wall you see a tapestry. And it's a huge tapestry, you know, 20 feet by 30 feet, and done during one of those periods of time way back when they had the time to make big tapestries like that. And in the picture of the tapestry, or the narrative of the tapestry, is, you know, two women sitting at a table over a bowl of fruit having a conversation. And you can see it. You get it. That's the story. That's the narrative of the tapestry. But as you walk closer to it, you get so close at some point that you can't see the whole thing. All you can see is the bowl of fruit. And you look at that bowl of fruit and you think, God, that's really an elaborate bowl of fruit. And you can identify the fruit and whatnot. But if you get really close to the tapestry, you don't see the narrative. You don't see the fruit. All you see is a bunch of colored threads tied in knots. That's it. It's just colored threads tied in knots. The pixels of the tapestry. And once you see the pixels of the tapestry, you understand how the story is made. You can be free of the story. You can then look at that tapestry, and you can either tune into the narrative, or you can understand the construction of the narrative, of the construction of the whole tapestry. Well, the same thing happens as we look at our mind. You know, initially we're just listening to and weaving into and analyzing and fixing and adjusting the narrative of the story. And awareness is helpful there because we can, you know, the self-improvement narrative. We can get wound up in that. But as you get closer to your experience and you start seeing it with the magnified mind of a mind that is stable, collected, then you see the pixels of experience that have gone in to making up this narrative. And it's just pixels of memories and plans and fears and joys, sorrows and sensations in the body and judgments and anxieties and stuff that gets all woven together into the story of my life. But once you understand them as just these impersonally conditioned and arisen momentary flickers of stuff that have happened that we've claimed as mine, once you understand that, then you can let them go. And it's by understanding the structure of the tapestry that we can see through the story of the tapestry. Same with our mind. Once we see through the construction and the pixels, the ingredients of the story, you can live in the story. You gotta have a story. You know, you gotta relate to each other. I'm the teacher. You're the student. That's a story. But it's all made up out of pixels. And if you're not caught in the story because you see the pixels, that understanding stops you from suffering. Or, I should say, minimizes suffering. Because you realize it's just a story. And if you want to believe it, and it's a story of suffering, well, you're choosing your own suffering. Not easy. That's how it happens, but it's not easy to disentangle because the stories are so compelling. We've been telling ourselves these stories for so long. We believe them. And the mind is often not powerful enough to see through the illusion of the story into the pixels and the impersonal nature of all the threads that we've woven into this story, that we've owned and woven into the story. But this is the process of freedom. This is the process of insight that gets close enough, sees the structure, sees the pixels, and understands how we've woven the story of, oh, poor me. So, well, good luck. Any comments, questions? Fears, joys, sorrows, ambitions, frustrations, disappointments, disbeliefs. Yeah.
I'm just going to have some confusion or frustration around with the stories that you shared around the testimonies or the experiences that some practitioners in Burma had about these miraculous
cures. Sure.
What has been powerful for me about the Dharma was really appreciating suffering comes from my attachment to wanting to get better, and the story that I have about that, and it's letting go of resistance that I have And even the story I think I've heard, if I've got that correctly, that Buddha apparently suffered a lot from back pain or experienced the pain of back pain, but he, with the kind of mind that he had, it didn't interfere with him expressing the Dharma, teaching the Dharma, being an effective, powerful force in the world for good. And so I think where I get a little hung up is like there's still maybe that's my spin on the story, but there's still something like, hey, you know, practice the Dharma and you will be healthy, or practice the Dharma and you will overcome your disease, as opposed to you will overcome your
suffering.
Your suffering. And sure. So I don't know if I'm going to get a response to that, but I know I get sure. hooked by the story of the miraculous recovery.
Sure. Yeah. No. I don't often, in fact, I've never talked about these stories or the mind is healing and the healing that takes place, and it's not meant to be a come on or a reason to practice, but nevertheless, things like that still do happen. So in this trusted audience of, you know, people who aren't going to go blab, I think you can handle the knowledge that such things happen. Now, it is. Practice is to reduce, minimize, eventually free yourself from suffering. But within the limits of a human life, you know, the body gets sick and the body dies. You know, no matter what they say, no matter how much nanotechnology is coming down the line, you know, in the next 10 years, you know what? The body's going to get sick and the body's going to die. So, we're not trying to stop that. We're not trying to be unnatural. We're not taking the mind into some unnatural thing. We still live within the laws of cause and effect. And one of the things that can be affected is our suffering. You know, if the causes and conditions are there, the mind is the cause. One of the the main cause and condition for suffering or non-suffering. Yeah, the Buddha did have backaches. But, you know, they say he had backaches and headaches, and he understood the karmic cause of that, and that it was a karmic result to experience that, but he didn't suffer. And they're like, oh, poor me, what a bummer, you know, where's the headache medicine or whatever? You know, he just endured it with awareness, full awareness. Not like gritting his teeth, but with understanding. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm Andy. Taking what you say about pixelated view of the tapestry or the threads as being causes and conditions, that's how I'm understanding.
Yes, yes.
And earlier this morning you had mentioned when you are experiencing those moments of awareness, say you're called off into thought somewhere, but you come back.
Yes.
And we should be trying to look at the causes and conditions of those moments of awareness.
Sure.
And this morning I was just totally drawing a blank on what that could even possibly look like. And then in this last sitting I was kind of having a little bit of a thought that trying to just be with that feeling and what was happening right around that time. It had something to do with something uncomfortable, some sort of dukkha, some body sensation or something was the trigger. But I'm wondering if you could point a little harder towards what those causes and conditions might possibly look like.
For awareness, you mean?
Yes.
For awareness to arrive. Well, let me ask you, how often did you experience awareness before you started practice? Never. Or almost never. And as you have continued to practice more, or when you've been in a retreat with us, what happens to the frequency of awareness? Well, it gets greater. What's different? Well, one is your intention in the mind. One is your valuing of awareness. One is, we might say, practicing repeatedly to be aware, even though we're not sure what it is we have to do in order to be aware. And it's like turning the mind in that direction and paying attention to moments of awareness and, really acknowledging moments of awareness that conditions greater awareness. That's one way to look at it. It's not, it's not like how you hold your hand. It's not whether you're sitting this way or that way. You know, while those things are tools, as I mentioned, they may be superficial conditions for it. But the Buddha said that when you see that you're having good practice, or when you see some period of greater awareness, take note of it. How'd you get there? What happened? You know, just to take note and to, what do you call it, acknowledging the sign of samadhi. You know, acknowledging the sign of samadhi, so that when you get samadhi, or when there's samadhi present, you acknowledge, what is the sign of it? How did you get there? What's the path to it? Not so you can hang on to it and repeat it again, but that you'll recognize it in the future when it arises. And it's a slow process of just, you know, recognizing again and again and again the nature of awareness. And as you know, as all of you no doubt seen, sometimes awareness is just so spontaneous and so quick and so clear and so precise and so effortless, wonderful. And other times awareness is so muddy and so thick and so, you know, nevertheless you're still aware. You know, as one of my teachers say, sometimes awareness is like looking into a bucket of clear water and seeing what's at the bottom of the bucket. And sometimes awareness is like reaching into a dirty old pail of old motor oil, and there's something in there, and you're trying to figure out what it is at the bottom. So, two different kinds of awareness, but still, both awareness. And we want to be careful not to get kind of locked into expecting or hoping or believing that awareness is only pristine, crystal clear, effortless. It's not. You know, awareness has many, I guess you'd say, dimensions and flavors and colors, and, you know, it happens in many ways. So just to take note of how you notice, what you notice. Some of it may not be very articulable. You know, it's hard to say what it is, but you can feel it, you can know it in here.
My name is Carolyn, and that sort of brings back the question I had earlier, which both yesterday and today you had after a sitting, you said something about you had a reflection and you were aware of having a reflection. And so what role does reflecting have? In a way, I think you're starting to touch on it right now in terms of, you know, paying attention.
Yes.
To something to understand why it happened. But also in relationship to Dharma, you know, as you get information.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. The role of reflection is a question about the role of reflection and how to use, when to use, and whatnot. There's, if you think about awareness and the development of mind, how you understand that, what you understand about it, how you understand that it happens, it all makes a difference as to how you will practice. And so, as you practice, you know, you try something, and you try it this way for a weekend or a day or a sitting or whatever, and then you might want to reflect on it and say, geez, that was not very successful. That was really a kind of a struggling thing. Maybe I'll make an adjustment. And then you try something else, and then you have a good sitting, so to speak. A good sitting meaning, well, you feel like there's a little more awareness or there's a little more clarity or whatever. And you say, oh, that was better. So you reflect on that. Well, how'd that happen? Well, I had this kind of attitude in mind, and I had this kind of... Okay, so it's good to reflect on your experiences, but awareness is not reflection. Really got to understand. Reflecting is an activity of mind. Awareness is something else. It's also an activity of mind. But so you can't just think yourself to awareness or think yourself to the benefit of awareness. Okay, but you can think about your practice of awareness, your experiences, and guide the development of awareness. You know, sculpt it and kind of move it in this direction or that direction based on your reflections upon practice and development of mind, understanding of mind, and all of that. So reflecting is valuable, but it's not a substitute for awareness. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned the pixel analogy and awareness is remembrance, and stating association, transient things coming and going. For events that we experience in our life, that's a little more easier to understand, but you also put karma in there.
Yes.
So how do you deal with the karmic elements?
So the question is, you know, all the pixel, all the threads and pixels that make up the narrative, you know, and the things that we remember about our life, we are obviously woven in there, but how do we get a handle on the karmic resultants that we're experiencing? I think to properly understand that, to kind of give you a full exposition, I'd have to give a kind of lengthy discourse on karma, you know, and what that is and what it isn't, and how we experience in this lifetime the result of previous karmic actions, whether previous being a minute ago or being a lifetime or two ago, and how we experience those karmic results now. How do we know it's a karmic result from a you know, a past experience or past this life, past other lives? We don't know. Only a very concentrated mind who turns its attention to that knowledge would be able to know. And most of us do not know. Most of us don't know that, you know, our good health or our bad health is a result of, you know, karmic actions in the past. We don't know that. It's an understanding that we can believe or not, or hear about and remain skeptical about, or just suspend our disbelief until we can confirm it ourselves. Maybe that's the best way. But it's just the Buddha's understanding. Because he didn't talk about it in terms of Western medical terms. He talked about health in terms of karma, food, weather, or environmental conditions, and the mind. Yeah. So,